Where is the storming of the barricades for the environmental movement, for climate change? Where is it? Because we're all getting on passively, it seems, with our lives.
The world's upside down, isn't it? It's all run by complete madmen and idiots, and basically men who don't know what they're doing.
That's Little Peppy, the young rap star with the melting ice eco rap. You can find it on YouTube. You know, it's his world that matters. It's his world that we're leaving behind. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Some big icons like General Motors may go crash, but most of the rest goes quietly with little announcement. I'm talking about all the small shops going dark, the once famous magazines gone and hardly remembered. Just a couple of years ago, I wished I'd had some videos of some of our major streets. Little malls and corner garages disappeared overnight, replaced with a big hole and a sign advertising Fenway Gardens, another deluxe condo tower. The building boom was disorienting. It's easier now. There's nothing new, and the old is slipping away. I should be happy. Finally, the fake consumer world is caving in. People are driving less to fewer jobs. Did we pull back just at the edge of carbon disaster? Just before the oil ran out? The collapse surprised common people and many in the left who didn't care much about banking and stock talk. Maybe we should have paid closer attention. You'll hear from Max Keiser, the lefty economist who did know and tried to warn us. In today's program, you'll also hear Professor Lord Anthony Giddens from the London School of Economics. He explores the links, good and bad, between the financial crash and the climate crisis. Lord Anthony also offers up three reasons why humans just don't get the climate predicament. We'll hear about it and do mostly nothing. Find out why. We touch on disappearing media and adaptation fairs, a couple of songs, but no dance. Well, let's get first right to an interview with Stefan Ferris. He's traveled the world only to find that climate disruption is already with us. His new book is one of the must-reads of the season. While experts struggle to predict the impacts of climate change out in the future, our guest, Stefan Ferris, says the big change is already underway. He's traveled the world to find out, and his new book is Forecast: The Consequences of Climate Change from the Amazon to the Arctic, from Darfur to Napa Valley. Stefan, you've written for magazines like Time and Fortune. How did you get started on this project?
Sure, it actually comes out of a reporting trip I did for Time magazine back in 2004 when I visited the refugee camps just outside of Darfur. And even then it was clear, I mean, there at the time I was reporting on kind of a human rights or a policy perspective, but even then it was clear there was an environmental cause behind this conflict, that it wasn't simply a fighting between, as they were saying at the time, Arabs and Africans, but really it was a fighting between kind of nomadic herders and sedentary farmers who had been able to coexist in the past, but all of a sudden, because of a long drought, were no longer able to do so. And that got me thinking about the environmental causes, and later on when I came across this idea that climate change may have been the actual cause of that drought, and therefore, to some extent, the cause of the conflict, I kind of set out to see how strong of a case could be made for that argument, and more or less convinced myself and got interested in climate change from that way.
Well, it seems to me that global warming is a lot like the trillions in the economic stimulus packages. We think our kids will have to deal with it. But you say millions of people are already hurting by a shift in the climate. Can you describe one of the worst cases?
Well, I mean, Darfur is almost certainly the worst case. Basically, that, like I said, that conflict comes out of a long drought that disrupted the social fabric of the place and then therefore made it basically, as one person told me, very dry kindling that you could then, it was easy to set on fire. Now, that drought, if you can trace it down, climate scientists have actually looked at computer models and have found that drought is consistent with changes in the global temperature of the oceans, the same type of warming that also could be causing stronger hurricanes. So you've got this kind of cause of warming water leading to a drought, leading to disruption, and leading to conflict. And I think that, to me, is certainly one of the worst cases. But my book was kind of looking at how climate change is playing out and will be playing out in the near future all over the world. So I also looked here closer at home, the United States. I looked at the Gulf Coast of Florida and Louisiana is where I went to, where kind of fear of stronger hurricanes, again, from that same pattern of warm water, is already, even in places that haven't been hit by hurricanes, disrupting demographics, making it harder for the middle class to live, because insurance companies have more or less decided that global warming is real and are adjusting their prices accordingly.
And they won't even write policies for a lot of those areas, and that makes you feel a little bit unsure about your home and your home value.
That's right. If they were simply raising rates, you might call it gouging or something, but the fact that they're actually pulling out of many markets altogether, that they've decided that the uncertainties are too great for them to want to be in there, shows that they're taking this issue very seriously.
And I've recently read that in California, the main water provider there has nothing extra to sell or auction off, and it looks like crop production could be hit even this year by the continuing drought. It's amazing that these signs are around us, and yet we don't put it together.
Right. Well, it's always very difficult, because even climate scientists will tell you we can't say for certain that the drought here in California, or for that matter the drought in Darfur, was for certain caused by the emissions from our factories and our cars and our power plants. What they can say is these are consistent with what we can expect of, and so as the world warms, we can expect droughts, disruptions of monsoons in the Darfur region. We can expect California to receive water. We can also expect the snow in the mountains that provides much of California's water to not freeze in the winter and therefore flow at the wrong time and therefore also lead to droughts. So that's part of it, is trying to untangle these things. So my solution was kind of to look and say, well, here's what the scientists are telling us we should be expecting. Let's go find examples of that, whether or not these specific examples are 100% related to climate change. And those will give us a window into what our future is.
Right. You have to separate, I guess, climate change from just plain weather. And that's difficult to do, isn't it?
It's very difficult. But the scientists do have these models with a pretty good idea. I mean, there's still a lot of uncertainty as well as to what's going to happen. And in some cases, we can speak very generally. We know that if temperatures get warmer, like in California, then the snow will no longer stick. And so, therefore, you'll kind of lose that natural reservoir of snow melt that you get here in California, or where I'm in California right now. And so you can kind of look at that and say, these are the type of trends we can expect, and let's go find examples of those trends that are happening now, whether they're climate change related or not, to kind of learn lessons about our future from our present.
I know you were just down in Australia after the deadly bushfires there. Do you think that the public are feeling that really is part of the climate change problem?
Right, and that's another perfect example. Climate change is expected to create conditions that lead to bushfires. These specific bushfires, it's hard to say whether they're interrelated or not, but we are expecting bushfires like that. And so, yes, the people of Australia have not just experienced these bushfires, they've experienced several long droughts, all of which are consistent from what we expect from climate change. And I was actually quite impressed by the people of Australia. They're on kind of a popular level. It seems to me it's one of the populations of the world that's kind of most worried and convinced about climate change and really want something to be done about it. And that makes a lot of sense, because they're a small continent without much room to adapt to climate change, and also they're already historically have been kind of on the limit of what's sustainable in terms of dryness and such. And so if the world gets more dry than they expected to, they're really going to be pushed over the edge.
And some other countries may benefit, Canada and Russia and Scandinavia. In my wildest dreams, those might end up being the most populous countries in the world if people have to shift north. We don't know that's going to happen for sure, but it's a possibility.
Well, sure. In the short term, some countries will benefit or are benefiting. I kind of focus my attention on the short term. For the long term, it's a bad story for all of us. So, for instance, I have a chapter on wine, and I look at California and Oregon, but there's certainly wines being planted up in your part of the world that are getting better and better because the climate's getting warmer and warmer, and it's getting easier and easier to grow them. It is worth noting that even if it's better for Canada and, say, worse for the United States, overall it's almost guaranteed to be worse, a negative shift, because even if we have simply a migration of planting, let's say the Corn Belt moves from the U.S. to Canada, well, you still have all the infrastructure that we've invested, kind of decades, if not centuries, of infrastructure in terms of physical things like rails or other things like legal rights or property rights that will have to be kind of started afresh. So if we were to start the world, let's say, warmer or cooler, it might not make a difference of where we plant our corn. But since we already have invested quite a bit in the way the world is now, overall for society, it's bound to be negative.
Mexico's in social turmoil as we speak. There's the drug wars, you know, and a sudden drop of production from their main oil field. That's going to impact their country finances. Did you find any climate impacts in Mexico?
I didn't look at Mexico very closely in terms of climate change. I mean, I did look a little bit, saw some tropical diseases might be moving from the equator up into Mexico and towards the United States. However, I have a chapter I looked at immigration. Now, I could have looked at Mexico and Central America, but I looked at Africa and migration into Europe. And basically, we look at climate change. We don't know exactly how it's going to strike and what form it's going to be, but it's going to be, as I explained before, kind of a disruptive force. And places like the United States or Europe or even Australia will be able to adapt to those because we have the resources, we have the resiliency. You know, we can, if diseases break out, we have healthcare systems that work. If hurricanes hit, we can rebuild. But it's going to be countries that are poor, like in Africa or like in Central America or Latin America, where their resilience is going to be lower. And so what's going to happen there is they're going to be struck by these same natural disasters, and kind of the impact will be the same, but their ability to adapt will be different. And so therefore, you'll get a lot more disruptions of lives and consequently an increase in immigration pressures. If you think of immigration as being a combination of kind of the bad life back home and the potential good life in your host country, well, that bad life back home is going to get worse, and so people are going to be increasingly feeling the pressure to move. So if you think of immigration as being one of the great kind of touchstones of especially American politics, well, we can expect those pressures to increase because of climate change.
And some of those poor countries are already having difficulty forming a good political stable system. One could imagine if big storms come through or continuing droughts come through. There have been some warnings even from the U.S. military that this is one of the greater threats that we will be facing. Did you see any signs of that already?
In a sense, all these countries are struggling under extreme pressure to build the kind of democratic institutions that will lend them more stability, and certainly any type of pressure, whether it's climate change or something else that's negative, is going to make those type of institution buildings much more difficult. There was a report by a group of kind of retired admirals and generals that I quote in the book, and they're talking specifically about this. They say the United States in the short term is going to be able to weather most climate change effects, but really the biggest impact is going to be the disruption of its neighbors and kind of increased immigration. One good example from the recent past is Haiti, which is not a climate change story, but it's an environmental story. They've basically destroyed the environment of that little island, or that half of the island that they're on. And so every once in a while you have these waves exoduses where people try to escape that environmental condition. Now take that and multiply it, you know, across the whole southern hemisphere, and you might have some real problems.
Well, Stefan Ferris, this book doesn't try to offer solutions. Why not?
Maybe that's for the next book. More seriously, I tried to limit the scope to something I thought I could handle that wasn't being talked about very much, which is the impacts of climate change as they're happening kind of here and now on a human scale. So much of the discussion on the impacts has been either very abstract, kind of like melting ice or drowning polar bears or things that are very far away and catastrophic, like much of Florida underwater. And so little has been really focused on the way it is going to impact us more subtly and more immediately. And so I really wanted to focus on that. The solution is obvious. We need to stop putting so many greenhouse gases up in the atmosphere. It's the method of doing that's the complicated part.
Well, you know, another problem I've been watching is sort of the death of the newspaper industry and a lot of journalists losing their jobs. I've heard there's actually been less coverage of climate change this year, even as we find out more about it. What are we going to do to keep communicating this issue?
That's a good question. I mean, news is tends to be based on the new, and I think editors are feeling that this story has been covered. So as people who write about it, we need to kind of find new and interesting ways to make the story, to make it relevant to people and make people understand this is not something that's kind of distant and far away and unsolvable, but something that's, let's say, much more immediate, closer, and something that we should be thinking about doing something about right away.
And you're covering it for an online journal, globalpost.com, is that right?
That's right. I am the climate change and environmental correspondent for Global Post. We're going to be exerting this book in the next few weeks, and then I'll be writing a weekly feature for them on various news about climate change and the environment.
You know, it's one thing to read about all this climate trouble as we research on Google or something, but you travel to the hot spots and the storm hits, meeting real people who are suffering. How did you handle that personally? Does it get to you?
Yes, I mean, it does. For me, it's always the things that surprise me. I've been working in Africa for the last 10 years, basically, in and out of Africa and other parts of the developing world. So these stories necessarily weren't new. I mean, Darfur was a terrible thing, caused by climate change or not. But it certainly is a constant reminder that there's people out there that are less fortunate than us that we need to be thinking about. In some sense, it's a terrible thing to see. In some sense, it helps keep your own personal issues and problems in perspective.
And is there something that we've missed here? Is there an underreported issue that you'd really like to get out to our listeners?
This book was very much a learning experience for me, and really the takeaway that I've had from it is that climate change isn't something that's really about the world. It's about something that's going to impact every aspect of our lives, whether it's the bills we pay at the end of the year, or whether it's the wine we drink, where our food comes from, the politics of our country. We've built our society on a climate that's been stable for 10,000 years, about the history of human civilization, and we're about to move away from that, and people should be thinking about what that means.
Yeah, and we don't know what we're moving away into. Our guest has been Stefan Ferris. His new book, Forecast, The Consequences of Climate Change, From the Amazon to the Arctic, From Darfur to Napa Valley. It's just out. Stefan, do you have a website where people can find out more?
Sure. It's stefanferris.com, and then Forecast also has a Facebook page.
And I'll just spell that for our listeners. Stefan is S-T-E-P-H-A-N, and Ferris is F-A-R-I-S. It's well worth checking out. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Stefan, thanks for all your research, and thanks for being here on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
They're not dying in Coventry. They're not dying anywhere in the United Kingdom. They're not dying anywhere in Europe. But they are dying in South America. They are dying in Africa. And they are dying in Asia. Climate change is killing the poor. Climate change made here in Europe, made here in Britain, made here in Coventry. This is no ordinary office block. For inside this building, plans have been drawn up that will exacerbate the problem of climate change for generations to come. In exchange for short-term financial profits and hiding behind the spurious rhetoric of keeping the lights on, Ian want to build a new coal-fired power station at King's North in Kent. A coal-fired power station that will drive a coach and horses through the UK's plans to cut carbon emissions. It is never too late for a sinner to repent.
Amen.
Ian, you can come forth today and repent, and we can work together to build a world free from climate change, a world in which we do not have to bury the dead as
That's
victims
right.
of climate change, a world where all can be included in the feast of life.
Yay! Hallelujah!
That is from the climate protest led this time by Christian Aid in Britain March 19th. There was a New Orleans-style funeral march, starting out from the Coventry Cathedral, led by the Reverend James Stuart Jones, Bishop of Liverpool, by the Green actress Greta Scacchi, and by Dr. James Hansen, a top scientific expert on climate. More than 1,000 campaigners from all over the United Kingdom joined in. These mourners for the future spoke outside the headquarters of a European power company called E.ON, just the letter E.ON. The problem? E.ON wants permission to build a new coal-fired power station at King's North in Kent. The company promises carbon capture and storage eventually, should that technology morph from fairyland into reality. The British public has had enough bad promises, enough floods and heat waves, and just plain screwy weather. Dr. Nicholas Stern has said this Kent North project should not go ahead, and he's been reporting on the climate and the economy in Britain for a long time. E.ON, a German multinational pushing coal tech throughout the world, and other British power producers are demanding up to $340 billion, candy money, from the government, threatening that the lights will go out in Britain by 2025 if they don't get it. The British Labour government has literally promised the sky for the past decade, but haven't delivered much other than wildly expanded airports, more roads, and hot air from the politicos. The government has set up a special department headed by Ed Miliband to keep pushing for coal with some sort of carbon capture. Margaret Thatcher got the country out of coal mining. Now the boys want to leap back in. It's like choosing the Middle Ages with the global thermostat cranked up to the maximum, of course. Why can't they see it? We'll get to that twist in human psychology in just a few moments with Lord Anthony Giddens. There was a plan, widely announced and producing much hope, to power one quarter of London with a giant offshore wind park. Imagine the start of a sustainable world city. Just last year, Prime Minister Gordon Brown promised 7,000 offshore wind turbines, taking alternative energy from the current 4% in Britain to 15% of all UK production by 2020. 11 years from now. The plans to take London one giant step towards energy self-sufficiency fell apart when oil multinational Shell backed out. The price of oil got cheaper, you see, so climate-safe power goes out the window. Had the government stepped in immediately to back that up, the wind park would be under construction now for a tiny fraction of the money passed over to the banks in the past few months. In the scale of history, remember, it is more important to balance paper bets than to preserve a livable climate on this planet. Of course it is. On April 1st, the Wall Street Journal reports the UK government will add a whopping 10 million British pounds to help wind energy. Set that against the hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of pounds poured into the big bank gambling. A pea-sized donation from a government that is still betting on coal. It is heartening to see the big religion people joining the scientists, environmentalists, and the public at large just saying no to coal. American James Hansen, chief scientist from NASA's Goddard Space Center, has gone from publications in scientific journals to the front line. He is desperate to prevent the climate catastrophe that he has studied and warned about for so long. Here is Hansen speaking in the UK, courtesy of Kent TV.
Well, I think the Kent situation is very key because it's symbolic. It'll indicate the direction that the country intends to go and the direction that the West needs to go. The United Kingdom and secondly the United States and Germany are the ones who are most responsible for the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So if we indicate that we're not willing to stop our own emissions, then there's no way that developing countries like China and India will pay any attention to us when we say there's a problem. You know, we will need to stop carbon dioxide emissions from coal if we're going to avoid large climate changes. When you burn coal, the carbon dioxide, much of it will stay in the atmosphere for more than 1,000 years. So we're creating future changes in the climate that are going to affect our children and our grandchildren and future generations. Well, as the climate gets warmer, the extremes of the climate become more extreme. So the atmosphere holds more water vapor as it's warmer, so we get stronger storms and heavier rainfalls and floods. But at the same time, at the times when the weather is dry, you get more extreme droughts and higher temperatures. The important long-term things are the stability of the ice sheets, which will eventually, over the next several decades, begin to have a big effect on sea level. Also, we're shifting the climate zones, and many species are not able to migrate fast enough to stay within their climatic zone. And we know from the history of the Earth, when we've had big climate changes in the past, we've driven half of the species on the planet to extinction. But we will do that on the 100-year timescale if we don't slow down the rate at which we're adding these gases to the air.
And here is Dr. Hansen, who I am now proclaiming a saint for science, explaining his role at the anti-coal protest March 2nd in Washington, D.C.
Some scientists say that you, one of the preeminent climatologists in the country and the world are risking your credibility by being also an activist. How does this square with your science?
I wouldn't say I'm an activist. I'm trying to make clear what the connection is between the science and the policy implications. There are people in the policy area who would rather not hear this. So somebody has to do it.
Are you here as an employee of NASA?
No, of course not. I'm here. I'm on vacation today.
And you're here as a private citizen then?
Yes, of course.
Some people are going to say, but you're James Hansen. You're always identified with NASA. And they're saying you're splitting hairs.
I'm also a Columbia University adjunct professor. I mean, I haven't given up my rights as a U.S. citizen, and freedom of speech is one of them. The main reason for this protest, we have to draw attention to make it clear that we want the actions that actually solve the problem. And that is not easy. There are a lot of green governments around the world, but in fact, the actions that they're taking are ineffectual. And it's proven by the fact that they're building more and more coal-fired power plants. And you can't solve the problem if you do that. I'm afraid that our government could very easily go down the same path as some of the other green governments.
And finally, civil disobedience, you're willing to, you expect to get arrested here today. You're willing to do that?
Well, I can't talk about this problem and then let young people get arrested and I stand back behind them.
You said that you believe the CEOs of some of the fossil fuel companies knew what they were doing, and you believe they should be tried for, quote, high crimes against humanity and nature.
Peabody Coal and ExxonMobil have put a lot of money into misinforming the public. I think that makes them guilty of crimes, but the judge will have to decide that.
James Hansen, where he goes, we all need to go. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, hoping for any hope. Big car dealerships are closing in America. Famous gas guzzlers like the Hummer may finally disappear forever. Air traffic is way down, ditto long-range shipping. Some Chinese factories have closed down. Can this human turmoil slow down our damage to the atmosphere? Let's go to a speech by Anthony Giddens, Baron Giddens, famed British sociologist, author of 34 books, and professor emeritus at the influential London School of Economics. He described the social structure of modern life. Now he is re-examining its validity, speaking lately of the future of world society. Google Scholar lists him, Anthony Giddens, as the most widely cited sociologist in the world. On February 28th, in the Sheikh Zayed's Theater at the LSE, Professor Giddens topped the literary weekend with his speech, The Financial Crisis, Climate Change, and Energy. I put a link to the whole speech in the Radio EcoShock blog entry for April 2nd. Just click on the blog button at ecoshock.org to find that. I was surprised to hear the first estimate of the impact on greenhouse gas emissions caused by the economic downturn. It may be the silver lining of a cloud that has darkened the lives of millions. The guesstimate in Giddens' speech comes originally from Lord Nicholas Stern, who has reported on climate change for the British government. Let's listen in. Here is Anthony Giddens.
Well, that's the scenario for the politics of climate change. What will the impact of recession be on it, and how will it interact with energy scarcity and energy futures? Well, briefly put, you can say there are three points on either side. There actually are some positives to the interaction between global recession and our need to hold back climate change. And these very briefly are the following. I won't go through them in detail because of the elapsing of time. First of all, we do have new leadership in the United States. That leadership could make a dramatic impact in the world community. It coincides with the advent of recession, which Obama's leadership has to cope with, but nevertheless, it's a big transformation. Among the many noxious things associated with the Bush administration, one of the main was the disinclination of that administration to do anything, really, concretely, about the very high level of emissions per person, greenhouse gas emissions produced by the United States. No attempt to introduce fuel levies, no attempt to control the impact of the large auto manufacturers, no attempt to control large-scale chemical and coal industries, with potentially disastrous consequences for the rest of the world. The US was free-riding off all the rest of the world during that period. Well, we do have new leadership, and it could and I hope it will, make a difference. Second, we get a temporary respite during recession, because since industrial production is down, therefore greenhouse gas emissions are down. Not for good reasons, but they are the one necessarily tails the other. So according to Nick Stern, you know, who's the author of the Stern Report, professor at the LSE, a 1% reduction in GDP produces 0.9% reduction in emissions. So if you look at the year 2009, which we're in now, industrial production is expected to fall by something just under 2.5% globally. So you would get something like a 2.25 reduction in greenhouse gas emissions this year, and that will probably be continued next year. But of course, it's only a temporary respite. Thirdly, perhaps in a way most importantly, recession, as we know from the past, produces innovation. And boy, do we need innovation. You cannot see the possibility of coping with climate change and coping with the associated problem of energy scarcity without massive technological innovation. None of the technologies we have at the moment, with the partial and controversial exception of nuclear power, are anywhere close to standing in for the role of oil, gas, and coal in our lives. Coal, incidentally, is a worse form of emissions than either oil or natural gas are. And there's a real worry that the world could turn back to coal as oil starts to diminish. So we need innovation. We need breakthroughs. We don't have those breakthroughs. I don't know if you know this, but at the moment, only 1% of total global energy is produced from renewable sources. Tiny, tiny percentage. If we're going to elevate that, as we need to probably 40 to 50% at least globally within 20 or 30 years, you know, we do need innovation. Well, recession, disaster, it could prompt such innovation, and we certainly have to hope so. The negatives, unfortunately, are also quite strong. I'll just trot through those quickly. First of all, in a situation of recession, climate change and energy tend to go on the back burner. Many politicians, essentially, and ordinary people put them out of their minds because they've got more immediate problems to concentrate on. When I'm worried about my next job, I'm probably not going to spend a lot of time on trying to change my activity in relation to climate change or energy. Second negative, the price of oil has dropped radically. As you know, it was about $160 in 2008. It's now down to just over $40. But when the price of oil is low, no one does much to change their activities, to economize on heating, for example, or on air conditioning, to use their car less or anything like that. So that, again, has a negative effect on climate change. And thirdly, also important, in a climate of recession, there isn't much money to spend on alternative technologies. So I just said that we need innovation, and we do need innovation. We need it massively. But actually, you look around the world, the proportion of money being spent on wind technology, solar technology, other alternative technologies has dropped off quite sharply during the early part of 2009. The reason is that as the price of oil drops, so technologies like wind power, for example, become even more uneconomic. Governments have to subsidize them for them to work. And so we look at this country, two or three big wind farm projects have recently been abandoned because the companies involved say they can't afford them. So recession is likely to have a mixed impact, really, climate change and energy. But in conclusion, I don't think that we should just draw a depressive, pessimistic conclusion from these observations, even though these are really, really, really difficult problems for the world to cope with.
So Anthony Giddens tells us we get a temporary respite from escalating greenhouse gas emissions simply because so much of the industrial economy has scaled down or shut down. A 1% reduction in GDP, that's the gross domestic product, should lead to almost a percent fewer greenhouse gas. That's about 0.9%, according to Nicholas Stern. Of course, that is a reduction from the ridiculously high production of CO2 and other greenhouse gases that are leading us to the climate catastrophe. Not a real reduction in damaging emissions as such, but a reduction in the carbon-spewing race and path that we were on. Keep that in mind. Still, some polluting countries are going through a terrific drop in production. For example, Russia is predicted to suffer a 7% loss of GDP, which could amount to about 6% fewer greenhouse gases. I'll add several question marks to that because this is more or less a guessing game until real measurements come back from the various scientific sampling stations around the world. We would expect a report on our new carbon path within a couple of months, I would think. The best we can hope is this. Greenhouse gases will likely continue to increase in the atmosphere, simply due to the ongoing industrialization of China and India, not to mention the rest of the developing world. Most of us are still driving around. We all continue to pollute, maybe just a little less. Perhaps the worst of global warming will be delayed a few years by the fall of the Grand Ponzi Scheme. But it is nowhere near enough to stop serious terraforming, like melting the polar ice cap and the world's glaciers. Those mega events are almost predetermined by the greenhouse gases we have already shot into the atmosphere, the heating in the pipeline described in the Radio EcoShock program of February 20, 2009. Find that in our program archive at ecoshock.org. The climate has already tipped. Now we are waiting to see how far. It's a good program. You should get it. February 20th, 2009, Radio EcoShock Show.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Why don't humans act to save themselves? Why? 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 As a world-renowned student of human society, Lord Giddens offers three answers to this key question. We'll hear them now.
What explains the gap between people's everyday lives, people getting on with their lives, many nations, many national leaders not taking that much notice, and what seems, so far as anyone who studies it can say, a very real and perhaps one of the most dangerous sets of threats that humanity... Very striking imbalance. I don't know how many people here went to Ulrich Beck's lecture, which I chaired on climate change the other night, but he had quite a vivid metaphor for this when he said, Where is the storming of the barricades for the environmental movement, for climate change? Where is it? Because we're all getting on passively, it seems, with our lives in the face of an enormously disturbing future, exacerbated by the other crises which I've just mentioned. Well, I think there is an answer to these questions, and or a series of answers, and those answers really situate the politics of climate change. They explain why it's so difficult to get effective political responses to climate change and, to a lesser extent, energy security and energy scarcity in the world. And there are three such factors I'll briefly mention. The first of these, if you'll forgive me, I call Giddens's paradox. Giddens's paradox states that climate change is a unique threat, which you've never had to face before, because it is based on abstract future risk. It's not, many people say to confront climate change, we need to mobilize as to fight a war. But when you fight a war, you've got enemies. You know who your enemies are. They're visible. You can easily relate to the issues faced when you're fighting a war. In the case of climate change, there are no enemies to discern in that sense. And the risks we face are risks. They're not so much visible dangers. You can't say of any particular episode, including the recent massive forest fires and brush fires in Australia, that they are inevitably and 100% sure the result of climate change. They probably are influenced by it, but we don't conclusively know. So Giddens' paradox states the following, that since most people can't relate to the abstract risks posed by climate change, since those risks don't intrude very far into their day-to-day lives, they therefore tend to push them for the most part to the back of their minds. Most citizens do this. Only about 15% of citizens in the industrial countries are activists, as defined by my final question to you, people who are really trying to change their lives to try to react back on the causes of climate change. only a very small minority are in that position. Giddens's paradox is a paradox because since these risks are not really visible, you could argue that people will only respond to them, and nations and the international community will only respond to them effectively when they are visible in people's day-to-day lives. But once they are visible in people's day-to-day lives, it is far too late to be able to cope with them. Dealing with climate change risk is not like having a pile of dust in the corner of your room, which you can leave indefinitely to get round to, because once the greenhouse gas emissions go into the air, at the moment we know no way in which they can be extracted systematically, and they are likely to stay there for centuries. So if we sit around doing very little, as we are at the moment, then we're building up a potential future cataclysm. It's because of Giddens' paradox, I think, that politicians who have caught on to the dangers of climate change are talking about it a lot, but not doing nearly as much as one would hope they would. Politicians are quite happy talking about what they're going to do 50 years down the line, the targets they're setting for 2050, let's say. They're not so happy discussing what they're going to do over the next 5 years, whether they'll stop building coal-fired power stations and so forth. The second sort of major political issue for climate change is what social psychologists call future discounting. It's not just the fact that climate change risks are abstract, it's the fact that we find it very difficult to give the same degree of reality to the future as we do to the present. If you offer people a relatively small gift in the near future, most will take it over a bigger gift offered in the long-term future. An example of future discounting is why young people smoke. You see 16-year-olds, these days I think a higher proportion of girls than boys actually, standing around smoking, and you think, what on earth are they doing? Smoking produces massive rates of death and incapacity for people. It's warned clear enough on the packets, what are they doing? Well, I think part of the reason is that when you're 16, it's incomprehensible that you'll ever be 40, that you'll ever be in a situation where you will suffer the consequences of your action. So our inability to give flesh to the future is one of the reasons why climate change risk still hovers uneasily in our lives, I think. Thirdly, and just as important as the others, there are fabulous problems of free riding in climate change politics, which we're really struggling to deal with nationally and internationally. I don't know if you know what free riding is, but I can explain it quite easily. If, let's say, a group of people in a neighborhood set up a neighborhood watch scheme, and everyone is charged, let's say, £500 to participate in that scheme. Four or five people in the area or more might decide they're not going to participate, but the scheme goes ahead anyway. So they're getting their protection for nothing. They're essentially free riding off the majority of people who paid for the scheme. Well, free riding is everywhere in climate change. The person who buys a Prius hybrid car, she does 65 miles to the gallon, so it's claimed anyway. It's free riding. Sorry, it is the someone down the round the block who drives a Range Rover is free riding off the person who bought the Prius. The person who bought the Prius is free riding off a person who gave up his or her car altogether and sticks wholly to public transport. Well, the massive problems in the world is the extent of free riding among nations. So that, for example, it could happen that the European Union, and maybe even the United States under its new leadership, which I'll talk about in a moment, could radically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Well, it wouldn't matter if nobody else in the world did. If China didn't take any action, for example, then it won't make much difference that the European Union and the US radically reduce their emissions. So therefore, people in the European Union and the US tend to say, well, why should we bother? And one of my pieces of research, admittedly not a systematic one, is talking to just people I sort of sit next to in the bus about climate change, which, you know, produces a weird sort of sensation from them. But many people will say, in the UK, we can't do anything. They seem to know that the UK only produces 2% of global emissions. And they say, well, you know, China, what can we do with such a small proportion of the world's population? Well, if you generalize that argument, obviously everyone will end up doing virtually nothing because everyone will be waiting for everyone else. So I'll come back to free rider problems in a moment because they infect all aspects of climate change.
That is Anthony Giddens, professor at the London School of Economics, speaking on February 28, 2009, in Britain. Find a link to the full speech in my blog for this program. Since our survival depends on this issue, let's quickly review Giddens' three engines of climate defeat, as it were. The first he calls Giddens' paradox. Climate change, he says, is a unique threat which we've never had to face before because it is based on abstract future risk. We cannot mobilize as in wartime because either there is no visible enemy in the climate change, or if there is, we are the enemy. The risk is mainly in the future. Although our first guest today, Stefan Ferris, found plenty of climate damage already. I've seen it myself in the dead pine forests of Western Canada. The polar ice has already melted dramatically, may I add. So climate disruption is less abstract and less futuristic, perhaps, than Giddens described. Still, we are asked to make a dramatic sacrifice for the next generation, for a climate that many of us will not live to see. That's hard. Doubly hard, when the gambling game of Wall Street has already grabbed the main stage and most of our collected wealth. We'll have to fight the climate dragon with one hand tied behind our back.
Thing police keep all boardroom reports, and we are not allowed to proffer the disaster accounts.
But here is the real paradox that Giddens offers. It is likely that human populations will only respond to climate disruption when it really impacts most lives. When the heat comes, the big storms wipe out cities, when new diseases arrive, when the Arctic is totally ice-free. The horrible truth is, then it will be too late to do anything useful about it. We are programmed to react to reality, but this reality is unforgiving. It means mass extinctions, including mass deaths for humanity. To overcome Giddens' paradox, we almost need an evolution in human consciousness beyond anything yet seen in our existence here on planet Earth. We need a quantum jump in social planning and action and in the way we think. Will it come? The second barrier to human action Giddens suggests is the difficult idea of future discounting. Humans value the present over the future. Imagine a monkey being offered a banana now or a promise of a banana a day starting a month from now. The monkey hand goes out for the banana in reach right now. That is us, and that is future discounting. The third big problem is free riding. While some of us give up a polluting car, someone else is buying up a super gas guzzler. They ride free on our sacrifice. Take that to the national level, and you see the problems facing climate negotiators. If one country takes an economic hit by limiting fossil fuels, another might go ahead with more coal burning. It is not insoluble in theory, but it is very difficult in the real world. I recommend you listen to the whole speech by Professor Anthony Giddens titled The Financial Crisis, Climate Change and Energy. Google it or get the link from my blog. Giddens is spelled G-I-D-D-E-N-S. Well, the challenge seems so huge, and our political circus so impotent and crazy, that climate despair is spreading. Even the longtime campaigner, author, and journalist George Monbiot is feeling the weight of inevitable failure. His March 17th column in the UK's Guardian newspaper is titled A Self-Fulfilling Prophecy. He might as well have called it No Surrender. I'll read you a couple of paragraphs from it. He says, quote, "Quietly in public, loudly in private, climate scientists everywhere are saying the same thing. It's over. The years in which more than 2 degrees of global warming could have been prevented have passed. The opportunities squandered by denial and delay. On current trajectories, we'll be lucky to get away with 4 degrees centigrade. Mitigation, limiting greenhouse gas pollution, has failed. Now we must adapt to what nature sends our way, if we can." This, at any rate, was the repeated whisper at the climate change conference in Copenhagen last week. It's more or less what Bob Watson, the Environment Department's chief scientific advisor, has been telling the British government. It is obvious, if unspoken, conclusion of scores of scientific papers. Recent work by scientists at the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, for instance, suggests that even global cuts of 3% a year, starting in 2020, would leave us with 4 degrees centigrade of warming by the end of the century. At the moment, emissions are heading in the opposite direction at roughly the same rate. If this continues, what does it mean? 6? 8? 10 degrees? Who knows? Faced with such figures, I can't blame anyone for throwing up their hands, says George Monbiot. But before you succumb to this fatalism, let me talk you through the options. Find the full article at monbiot.com, spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T. George Monbiot concludes, if we behave as if it's too late, then our prophecy is bound to come true. However unlikely success might be, we can't afford to abandon efforts to cut emissions. We just don't have any better option. On his website, George Monbiot adds, if you think preventing climate change is politically difficult, look at the political problems of adapting to it. Well, I'm Alex Smith, and personally I don't think our political system can survive a rapid shift in climate and all that comes with it. In fact, our current politics may not even survive the great global financial swindle already upon us. I welcome your opinions. Here is the email address, radio@ecoshock.org. This program often reflects listener suggestions and tips, this week especially from Carl, who also created our Green 960 AM radio webpage. Thank you, Carl. Maybe the next civilization will be more sane. It may have to, just to survive it all. That is the hope.
Freud said that every crisis is a kickstart to the positive side of the personality. And I think for every social crisis, you could say the same.
Well, just to whip things up, here's a little something from Max Keiser's latest radio show. That's at maxkeiser.com, spelled K-E-I-S-E-R.com. Well, he does a great thing on Radiance FM in London, and it's only broadcast in London. They won't take it in North America, apparently, because people on the left, where Max Keiser resides, just aren't interested in business issues or haven't been up until now. And he says he's been telling environmentalists all along, Greens, get going. Look at the fraud behind the pollution. Let's listen to Max.
The banking system is ultimately the most polluted of all systems, of all ecosystems in the world. The water system, the earth, the space junk, all the toxicity in all the world, the most polluted of all environments is the banking system with all these debts that are, they're like, you know, the Exxon Valdez spilling oil into the Alaskan Sound is like AIG spilling hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars worth of toxic debt into the world financial ecosystem. You know, another point I made to environmentalists that before you can take on Exxon, before you can take on these corporations for harming the environment, you have to take on their balance sheet because they're the biggest purveyors of toxic debts. And I said, look at these companies. They're swapping worthless pieces of paper and calling that banking and making fees and using that fees to influence government officials to pass laws that hurt the environment. Stop the counterfeiting first. Stop the malfeasance first. Take, you know, these environmental groups should have an office on Wall Street. And they should be cleaning up the environment of money first. That's the mother of all toxic environments. And again, everybody on the left is like, no, we're afraid to take on the banks. People will perceive our mission as having strayed from the environment, and they'll stop giving us their $5 and $10 donations, and we'll just dry up, and we won't be effective at all.
Yeah, well, but they were also focused just on the symptoms of the financial fraud. That's what you were arguing, is like the Exxon Valdez spill is the symptom of a financial fraud. So go to the root of the problem, not go after the financial fraud has already happened months or years before.
That's right.
When they sold, you know, collateralized debt, or they bought
CVS. They got AIG to insure the run-up on and spilling oil.
Exactly. So why would you wait for this oil spill to happen? You're focusing on stopping the oil spill from happening, when if you stopped the CDS from being sold.
Yeah. When you stopped the financing of the operation carrying the oil in the first place, you're going to have a lot, be a lot more effective in stopping the oil spilling.
Yeah, when you stop the transfer of risk that was happening. Now you're seeing that, as the collapse happens, that this is what has happened. It was a transfer of risk.
Yeah.
So these corporations, as you said over and over, and you said to the head of Greenpeace that they, you know, if you go to them and tell them that you're, you know, you're trying to stop them from, you know, that they created this much pollution and that they should stop, they don't stop. They just go to AIG and buy insurance.
Right. They buy more insurance. So every time Greenpeace shows up in Exxon and says, here are the five things you're doing wrong that are going to cause ecological holocaust, they just call up their insurance broker at AIG or whomever and buy more insurance. And because to pay for the insurance, by the way, they're going to actually lower their operating standards and increase the risk of causing an environmental damage. In other words, if Greenpeace never went there to begin with and just kept their mouth shut, the net result will be less environmental damage, because by articulating what the environmental potential damage is, you're giving these environmental abusers like Exxon and these other companies the ability to give themselves a false sense of security by overinsuring themselves through intermediaries like AIG.
Yeah, but also they, by Exxon going to the likes of AIG to buy these credit default swaps and insurance products, they were building a very powerful ally. So they through the CDS, AIG became more than just a, you know, mom and pop insurance company. They became a very powerful conglomerate. So they then would use their own power to make sure that this sort of Exxon Valdez situations would happen or could potentially happen, because mm-hmm. then they were making money from selling all these products.
Right. And then the other part of the equation is that when an Exxon Valdez happens and it causes ecological holocaust, the money used to clean it up is considered a GDP boost. So the accident and the spill and the catastrophe are all considered to be GDP boosting events, because the actual cost of the loss of ecosystem is not calculated in any GDP numbers in any country. You know, the services provided by nature, for example, you know, photosynthesis that creates oxygen by plants inhaling cow farts is not calculated in any GDP statement. The waves and tidal system that carries ships and boats and sailing vessels around the world is not, we don't pay for that. We don't get a monthly bill from God for photosynthesis. We don't get a monthly bill from God for cross-pollination, cross-fertilization.
Believe me, I'm sure Monsanto is trying to think of a way. If they own all the plants.
Well, Monsanto, of course, is figuring out ways to basically commoditize seeds and to create more, you know, seed-backed securities to financialize what has hitherto been offered completely for free. That's true. But you see, none of these costs show up on any of these corporate balance sheets in any way. And as such, they're not calculated in GDP, so you have a total false reading of GDP. You know, for every dollar in GDP, you've got many more dollars in ecological devastation and damage.
I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock. We'll go out with this entertaining little ditty, The Morbid Magazine Song by Bill Dizel.
The many paper publications writers once were writing for have mostly disappeared and left a handful all are fighting for. They went by names like Mirabella, Cosmo Girl, and Living Well, Amazing Stories, Omni, and Organic Style of Mademoiselle. And Spirit of Aloha, which you may perchance have read in flight, and also Windows Sources, Home PC, Musician, Q and Byte, and 7 Days, and Audio, and Quick and Simple, and Cachet. And PC Magazine, but no one understood that anyway. When Budget Living says they're broke, you know conditions aren't so nice. And don't forget Success, whose claim to fame is that they failed twice. McCall's Industry, Standard, House and Garden all had gone away. And Rosie sank as fast and deep as Underwater USA. When Country Journal, Harper's Jewish Woman, Coronet and Mode have followed New Age Journal as they all were flushed on some commode. When Blueprint's future plans have all been relegated to the past. And National Lampoon will surely not be who is laughing last. When women's sports and fitness go for women, gusto sink and spy are only sold along with lifetime at that newsstand in the sky. All writers start to fear that their careers are headed for the drain. A lot like talking shot and life and looking there's in George and Jane. The experts all are telling us that in our brand new century, there'll be new opportunities, exciting and adventure-y. But to a freelance writer, none of this may seem too funny, cause you know the next to go will close up shop and owe you money. Yes, to a freelance writer, none of this may seem too funny, cause you know the next to go will close up shop and owe you money.